folks. I'm Jeff King. I'm the president of Constitution Summer. We are a mostly youth-led group that is nonpartisan, coming out of law schools and universities around the country. We're the folks who are responsible for the Berkeley ballot impeachment initiative. And these are the private citizens, but we'd also like to thank very much the public officials who made that happen. Chris Worthington is here. Jason Overman's here. Steve Friedkin, who actually helped draft, mostly drafted the language that we then worked on, is here. And if there's anybody else, raise your hand. We put impeachment on the ballot in Berkeley. It got a lot of press. And we are working now to do that in other cities or help other cities do that. And we're hoping they will. I don't have a whole lot to say because obviously I pale in comparison to the people sitting next to me. So I guess I'd just like to thank everybody for coming out. I would like to mention that Santa Cruz next week will be looking to, they're going to have their city council going to consider putting impeachment on the ballot based on our language. So, if any of you are from Santa Cruz, or have ties to Santa Cruz, it might be a good time to visit. I believe that's the 25th. And there may be other cities in California. As Sheena Katadal from the Center for Constitutional Rights mentioned, there's Rule 603 of Thomas Jefferson's Rules of Parliamentary Procedure, which actually allows a state legislature to send articles to the House. We think it would be great to see California do that. And there is a resolution pending in California that if we can put pressure, may move forward. This is Bill Goodman. He is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's going to be speaking.
Sorry?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here, and I want to congratulate Constitution Summer for the wonderful work it's done in organizing this meeting tonight. So, on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights, anyway, welcome to the first annual Impeachment Day event. because we're coming back. That's our message. Congress doesn't get it. The courts don't step up to the plate. We, the American people, are coming back. And it's not just the marginalized left, not just the remains of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, or the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's those who can no longer stomach the criminal dismantling of the democratic institutions, indeed of democracy itself in this country. For example, it's the leaders of the Judge Advocate General's office, in the Department of Defense, who testified against what is going on in Guantanamo recently in Congress, people who would never be expected to chime in on an issue like this. It's the lawyers from the Department of Justice and the Office of Professional Responsibility who wanted to investigate the NSA program, the NSA wiretapping program, and were denied security clearances by the president himself so that investigation could not go forward. These are people who are a part, not even a part of the mainstream in America. They're part of the Republican Party. Well, not necessarily the Judge Advocate Generals, but they're part of the military establishment. They're part of the right. They're part of the Republican Party. But they cannot stomach this any longer. And they've stepped up to the plate. So our message tonight is that we will be back. And I want to say this. Until tonight, I have not had a chance to see the movie before, which involved statements from myself and all of my colleagues. And while I've heard it before, I didn't quite realize the breadth of the material that would be covered in the film. So if I repeat any of it tonight, I apologize. I've got a few prepared remarks. I would like to start this discussion tonight with a very basic civics lesson. As the way in which the United States government has been constituted for 300 years, there are a few very basic principles that say that the government, the police, the FBI, the CIA, even the President of the United States may not do, and a few things that they must do. So let's just take a look at what, it's pretty basic, it's pretty clear, pretty simple, This is what American government looks like, and this is what American democracy looks like, at least looked like, until the 2000 election. You're not supposed to arrest people without reasonable cause. That's in the Fourth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, it's clear. You're supposed to hold someone without charging them with a crime. And then after you charge them with a crime, you have to bring them before a judge within 48 hours and produce some probable cause as to why they're being held. That's also a guarantee of the Fourth Amendment. You can't lock up people and hold them indefinitely. That's the Fifth, Sixth, the Eighth Amendments of the Bill of Rights. You can't torture people. That's the Fifth Amendment and the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. In addition, we now know, we realize and can recognize that government must acknowledge that incorporated into the Constitution of the United States, incorporated into the legal fabric of our lives, is a basic proposition that international law, both written and customary, is the law of this land, international human rights law in particular. That includes international conventions and treaties. It includes, most recently, things that have been discussed at length, the Geneva Conventions. In addition, a seventh point, I've now gone through six basic points of American democracy. Here's the seventh point. American people have a right of privacy. Since 1967, the United States Supreme Court has realized and recognized and proclaimed that that right extends to our telephone conversations and now our email conversations. And that is guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And that right of privacy, as I said, which was acknowledged for telephone conversations, extends, as of 1972, to a right of a woman to have a choice as to how her body is going to be, who will control her body, whether it be her or the state. And the Supreme Court has said since 1972 that it's her. That's right of privacy, number seven. Number eight, government cannot discriminate against people, at least since the Civil War, based upon race, religion, or ethnicity. And number nine, this government, any government in this country, must allow its citizens to vote for the government, and it must permit that vote of each individual to be counted fairly. I'm glad that there is some applause for that, because it sounds strange after what we've been through for the last 6 years. Much of our experience with violations of these rights, much of our experience at the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been woven into our cases, has been woven into the cases that the lawyers who were in the film tonight describe. And not only those cases, but countless of other cases. And here's been our experience. This is what has happened, especially since 9/11, in this country, when you hold the actions of this government up to the template of what I just described, a democracy, the very simple contours the construction of democracy should look like. This president has been assaulting and undermining the Constitution of the United States. Today we're confronted with a grave constitutional crisis. We have a president who is staunchly committed to acquiring unprecedented amounts of power and using it in ways that conflict with the Constitution of the United States, that conflict with international law, that conflict with a common understanding of morality. In other words, although the president has sworn to uphold the Constitution, he is doing just the opposite. He is destroying and dismantling the Constitution of the United States. And he is doing that. He is assaulting and undermining the Constitution in a number of ways. Primarily his purpose is, as I said, to gather even more power, power that is unprecedented. This presidency is engorged with power, bloated with power, to gather even more power for the president, in particular this president. And that was verified by a statement made by the Vice President of the United States immediately after there was a disclosure of the NSA wiretapping program. What Cheney said was basically tacitly admitting, that there was no need for them to have this to circumvent the FISA courts, to not go to a FISA court, the most compliant court. What Cheney said was, look, it's really not a question of whether we have to go to the FISA court or not. What we need to do is to refurbish, to build up, increase the power of the presidency that has been eroded since when? Since Watergate. Since Watergate, this is what the power of the presidency reached its low mark, according to this vice president, literally, probably the most powerful man in the United States, at the moment of Watergate, and now it has to be rebuilt. There have been summary arrests in the United States engaged in by this president. Immediately after 9/11, thousands of non-citizens were arrested, were picked up, were held on ostensible and pretextual immigration charges, but basically they were criminal, they were being investigated for criminal charges. And these men were held under conditions that were, they could best, at best be, in many ways, be described as torture. They were routinely beaten, they were kept with, I now can relate to how they felt, they had the lights on 24 hours a day. And they were not allowed to sleep, and these men were not brought in front of any judge, despite the fact that the Fourth Amendment requires it, and told what crimes they were charged with. They were ordered deported and held long past their deportation dates, so that they were singled out because of their ethnicity, they were singled out because of their religion, they were singled out because of the fact that they were immigrants, and they were held under terrible conditions. And it's not I that said that. This was all incorporated in a report of the Office of the Inspector General of the Justice Department, who found that the conditions of detention for these men were outrageous. Let's take a moment and take a look at Guantanamo, another example of people who were picked up around the world. Bounties were put up, literal treasures for somebody living in the wilds of Western Afghanistan, who can say for $5,000 the Army will give you five, the United States Army will give you $5,000 if you find us someone who's connected with the Taliban or is connected with Al-Qaeda. And of course, they drop a dime on their landlord, or they drop a dime on their tenant, or whoever, or their political opponent, or someone who's got a job that they want. And literally, I know people at Guantanamo, clients of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who fit every one of those categories, who are there unjustly. The next thing they know, they are drunk, they're handcuffed, they're blindfolded, they're in a plane, and they're in Cuba. And they are not being investigated by the Treasury Department for illegal travel to Cuba either. So, the United States Supreme Court just addressed this issue in a case called Humdan versus Rumsfeld. And in the Humdan case, the opinion is very important because it makes a few salient points. First of all, this executive branch, despite the fact that it thinks it can do whatever it wants, that it is not constrained by the laws of the land, has to comply with the law of the land. It cannot act unilaterally. It has to act with either congressional authority and within the Constitution. And beyond that, and perhaps more important, this administration has to comply with what's called Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which means the most basic of human treatments has to occur. People cannot be degraded. They cannot be tortured. They cannot be interrogated in ways that are tortured under Common Article 3. They cannot be detained indefinitely. They have to have a fair tribunal, one which is not a kangaroo court, which is what has been occurring up until now. All of these things were pronounced by the United States Supreme Court 5-3, and really, if you count Roberts, who voted against that position in the D.C. Court of Appeals, it's 5-4. It's close. We're hanging by a thread there, but we won, and we won decisively. When I say we, I mean all of us in the Humdan case, and we should all be very proud of the United States Supreme Court and of what Justice Stevens wrote in that particular opinion. Now, What has the Bush administration's response been to this? It has been, in my opinion, rather brainless, rather moronic, but it has been consistently to undermine the rule of law that was outlined and the light that was shed upon the rule of law by the opinion in the Hundred case. It immediately has confiscated all of the legal papers of prisoners who exist who are being held at Guantanamo. That means letters and documents that we, the lawyers, have brought down to them, have shown them, pleadings, papers, legal letters, have been confiscated so they can't see that. And to resist and to continue to say that the right of habeas corpus, which was upheld for prisoners at Guantanamo 2 years ago in a case called Rizzle versus Bush, still means it's only jurisdictional. The courts only have jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus petitions. Courts do not, that jurisdiction means nothing. Once you get in the door in that courtroom, you still have no rights. This continues to be the position of the Bush administration and this Justice Department. And this is further evidence of the lawlessness of this administration. There's been, of course, suppression of free speech since 9/11, and most dramatically we saw it on the streets of New York during the Republican convention, where again thousands of people were held for days longer than necessary in a place that we call Guantanamo on the Hudson, 57, under conditions that were extremely unpleasant. Only so that they could be held on ice, so that they could, that the Republicans could have their convention and get out of town, and then they were released. And this kind of pattern has been replicated all over this country, throughout the United States, where people have protested the actions of this administration. I know it happened here in Oakland immediately in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Yet worse, this government has sought to eliminate judicial oversight consistently in one area of our government after another, in the area of judicial detention, executive detention, whether it be in Guantanamo or whether it be in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, in the area of wiretapping. They've strenuously attempted to undermine any judicial oversight, even the oversight of a court like the FISA court. And that consistent attempt across the board to undermine the role of courts is an attempt not only to undermine the role of courts, not only to weaken lawyers and accuse lawyers, which they've done with regard to Guantanamo, by the way, it is an attempt to undermine the rule of law. It is an attempt to say the only law is what we, Bush, Rumsfeld, and Cheney, say, that is the law. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, when that is the law, we have no law. That is the basis, one of the strongest bases for impeachment. I want to just talk about the wiretapping program for a moment. Shane Cadell from the Center for Constitutional Rights, I think, talked about the issue fairly clearly. The thing that we have to understand when we talk about impeachment, we talk about high crimes, misdemeanors, and I think that the case for high crimes and misdemeanors has already been clearly made. What needs to be understood here is that the wiretapping which has occurred is wiretapping which is our electronic communications that occur between the United States and outside the United States. Now, it may well be that there has been widespread wiretapping or trolling for telephone conversations and other electronic communications that are purely domestic. That has not been disclosed yet. I suspect that may underlie some of the resistance of this administration to allowing these lawsuits or to fighting these lawsuits from going forward and having the judge really rule on the constitutionality of this program. But what they admit, what we know, is electronic surveillance that occurs between conversations that occur between someone in the United States and someone outside of the United States. These conversations are clearly, exclusively controlled by a statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as the FISA statute or FISA Act. This law not only says that that there is only one way in which these kinds of electronic communications can be intercepted,
And that is by getting a judicial warrant from this FISA court, one of the most compliant courts I have ever heard of in my over 40 years of practicing law, a court that has granted over 10,000 of these warrants to the United States government when requested, and denied fewer than 10. That's a pretty good batting average. Why in the world would this administration want to subvert and undermine that program when it gets everything it wants by using the judiciary? It is to, as the Vice President of the United States said, to rebuild the power of the President that has been eroded since Watergate. And there are now 100 of these cases in one form or another in which this issue has been raised. There's one that's in San Francisco that I know about that's been filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the communications servers, AT&T or Verizon, whoever it is, out here, Bell West, whatever it is. There's one that's been filed by us and by the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, a case that I'm very proud of the title, called CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights versus George W. Bush. We're proud of that. There's one that the ACLU has filed in Detroit, Michigan. And there are a number of others that are around the country. They are now working in unbelievably strenuous ways to get these cases from being heard. The first thing they've done with all of these cases throughout the United States is file a motion to get the cases dismissed based on something called the state secret doctrine. That means, basically, you can't go there. I'm not going to tell you why you can't go there. That's a secret. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And judge, you should dismiss it. You can see the documents, but you can't keep them. We'll take them back from you. And now you should dismiss their case. And once you dismiss their case, they can appeal, but they don't know why they're appealing. Now, if this sounds like justice to anyone in this audience, you know, I come from Brooklyn where I can sell you a bridge. So, the state secrets doctrine, which has been used more by this administration in the last 6 years than it has been throughout the history of the existence of this doctrine, which is questionable to start with, is something that I think we're going to see more and more of. And again, it's a way of saying the courts have no business intruding into what the government does, what the president does. We are all powerful. We will not have anything to do with the courts. Another thing they've done is they've gone back to Congress at this point and said, all right, pass a new statute that will say that the constitutionality of this program will be decided by the FISA court itself. In other words, we're going to take all these cases away from these judges out here in San Francisco, and the judge in New York, and the judge in Detroit, and the judge up in Portland, Oregon, and all judges all over the United States. We're going to take those cases away from them. We're going to give them to the FISA court. Now, the FISA court is a court that, unlike all other Article III courts, is appointed, serves temporarily, and is appointed by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And this court will decide whether the program is constitutional or not. Well, they're afraid to have some independent-minded judges decide these cases. They're really afraid. They're afraid of what's going to be disclosed, and I think what probably they're fearful of in terms of disclosure is the fact that it's not just calls from the United States to outside the United States, it's vast numbers, millions and millions of millions of electronic communications from me to you, from you to your wife, from you to your boyfriend, girlfriend, or kids, or whatever, or parents. Those are the calls that they're afraid that will be disclosed, and people will realize that not only is the doctrine that the government may not intrude upon our privacy dead, but our privacy is long gone and long dead. And then the people will really rise up, and this movement towards impeachment will grow even stronger. This government has routinely tortured people, not only in Bagram in Afghanistan, not only in black holes around the world of ghost detainees whose names we do not even know, but at Guantanamo, where we do know who the people are, where the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, was on the phone on a weekly basis, understanding the details in which a man named Mohammed al-Qahtani was tortured routinely. These are the things that we can talk about when we talk about torture. As I said, It has been fortunate, I think, it's been personally fortunate for me to be at the Center for Constitutional Rights where we have had these cases, cases like Meher Arar that Marilyn had talked about, where we can see not only the ways in which the Constitution has been violated, but the vast sweep of the plans and programs of this administration to undermine and destroy the Bill of Rights and the rule of law in this country. And because we have been fortunate enough to find in our workplace, that in our workplace, that is in the courts, where we work, is exactly the area that this administration, that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, that these people do not want us to be because it represents a check on their grandiosity, a check on the bloated power of this particular presidency. I feel it's been particularly enlightening for us to be working in this area. That is why we undertook to write this book. And I don't think there are copies of it out here, but I urge you all to, I think there are order forms, you can get it at a discount. I urge you all to read the book. I think it's pretty well done, pretty useful. Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. Thank you, Dan. I want to just end with a quote. It's from Shakespeare. It's from Julius Caesar. Cassius says, "Why, man, he doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, and we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep around to find ourselves dishonorable graves. In the end, this enormous challenge provides us all with an enormous opportunity as well to engage the American people in a discourse about what kind of society we want to live in, so that there are no more colossuses, so that we have no need to search for dishonorable graves, so that in this time of dishonor, we have engaged in an honorable task. I urge every one of you, if you haven't seen it, to see the movie Good Night and Good Luck, which is about McCarthy and Edward R. Murrow. And in addition to the fact that there's a great score, Diane Reeves is wonderful, sings these great songs in this movie. In addition to that, the message of that movie is that there are three things that tyranny requires and thrives on. One is fear, one is secrecy, and the last one is silence. And that's it. What we have to do, what impeachment means, is that we will not be silent. It will not be secret. We will not be afraid. We will fight back. Impeachment.